Welcome to Wherever You Are. This is Ryan McNeil in Toronto, Canada, and you are listening to part three of Life in Technicolor. It's the matinee cast offshoot dedicated to the goings-on at Hot Docs, North America's largest international documentary film festival, happening right now in my hometown of Toronto, Canada, until May 5th. Part 3 is an episode that was actually 3 years in the making, and it gets me sitting down with director AJ Schnack, who is the founder and brains behind the Cinema Eye Awards, kind of the Oscars for documentary nonfiction filmmaking. He's also the director of We Always Talk to Strangers and Caucus, a new film about the Republican primary in Iowa back in 2012. It's a really cool film, even if you are not a Republican, don't even like Republicans. It's a great watch that I was really happy to sit down and talk to him about. So come with me to the Pilot Tavern to talk to AJ Schnack about his new film, Caucus. AJ Schnack, welcome to Hot Docs.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations on Caucus.
Thank you.
It's been very, very well received. A lot of my listeners will not have seen it, unfortunately. I have 16 listeners and they're very sheltered.
Right. They don't get out much.
No. Tell people briefly what Caucus is about.
Well, in 2011 and early 2012, my filmmaking partner Nathan Trustell and I went to Iowa and decided we wanted to follow all the candidates on the Republican side who were running for president of the United States. Iowa's the first contest of the U.S. political season, so it's a really interesting time to sort of be around them as they're figuring out, you know, what kind of candidate they're going to be, how they're going to interact with people, formulating their message. It's a time that is that they're much more available both to individuals and also to the media. So it's a chance to kind of see people in an unfiltered way that I think can be kind of illuminating. And I'm really excited about what we came up with.
Very cool. You mentioned in the post Q&A you're a Democrat.
Yes.
So why make a film about Republicans?
Well, we'd made a film called Convention a few years ago, which was about the Democratic Convention in Denver,
right,
in 2008. And, I had a lot of people say, like, oh, well, would you have made a movie about the Republican Convention? And actually, that year, it might have been even more interesting because Sarah Palin, there was all this drama over whether Sarah Palin was going to give a good speech or a bad speech. And she gives this, you know, kind of rabble rouser about lipstick on a pig. They canceled the first day of the convention. You know, George Bush doesn't even go to the convention, and then they have tons of protests.
Right.
So there were a lot of really interesting storylines around it, and it just made us think again about, like, okay, we've made a film about Democrats, and I've always wanted to make a film about the Iowa caucus, and the idea of doing it about Republicans, particularly at a time when you knew that they're sort of their rage about Obama was going to be kind of hitting, you know,
they were on attack mode
the full peak, yeah,
in this last election.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was like, you know, and as a, you know, as a Democrat, you know, I remember what it was like in 2004 when, you know, people's passions on that side were really high about finding a candidate who was going to defeat George W. Bush.
How'd that work out?
It didn't. Yeah, didn't. And for similar, and strangely enough, we picked a guy that not that many people were excited about, who was from Massachusetts. I totally understand, like, what the Republicans went through this past year. So, but it was fun to look at an election from the Republican side. It was, as documentary filmmakers, we don't often portray Republicans without making them look a little silly, perhaps.
Right, yeah. Right. One kind of nuts and bolts question, just because a lot of the people I know would probably kill me if I didn't ask this. The Ross brothers, who were here last year with an amazing film called Chapatulis, they were involved with this film. How did they come into the fold for Caucus?
Bill and Turner are really good friends of Nate and mine. We have a lot of crazy adventures together. And, you know, they came on during the last week of the campaign when a lot of press was going to be there.
Okay.
And press from all over the world, and the candidates were going all over the place. And it was basically the kind of thing where I had to say, like, Turner, you're going to go to Oskaloosa. Here's your camera. Here's your address. This is what we need.
Right.
And Turner's, you know, the guy who will do that. And then we'd all reconvene back in Des Moines in some terrible bar and drink, and we would watch CNN and see the coverage of the day, and we'd all point to say, like, see if we could see ourselves in the footage. So it was you know, 95% of the film is just Nate and I in Iowa, but it was really... It was really fun to have them come in at the end.
Do you now owe them a favor on their next project? Did you do anything on River?
No, River was done before, right before we did Caucus. So, no, I've told them I will gladly, wherever they want me to go. I'm glad they're there.
Yeah. So, the film kind of begins around the time of the Iowa straw poll, which to me as a foreigner seems absurd. You've got these candidates. Like, first of all, it holds no bearing. It's just it's kind of a show of hands, really.
It's a fundraiser for the state party, basically.
Okay. I was gonna say because they have like petting zoos and concerts and face painting and carnival. Going into like, had you never been to that before?
No, and it was hard for me to sort of wrap my brain around. You know, it's a very interesting event. Basically, the state Republican Party, and I haven't been to a Democratic straw poll anywhere, so I can't say if this is the same in Iowa or elsewhere, but the state Republican Party would have this event, and they would basically auction off space, tent space, close to the Coliseum in Ames. And then candidates buy tickets. And the tickets are your vote.
Okay.
And candidates then give out these at all over the state, and they arrange for buses to drive people from all over. One of the things, you know, we didn't end up using of Ron Paul, but one of the great things is all the candidates said, you know, like said, like, we bought your ticket. Ron Paul only bought half your ticket. You still had to pay for half your ticket if it was Ron Paul, which I thought was kind of great. But it's an amazing event. There's been a lot of criticism, you know, after Michelle Bachmann won this last one. A lot of people think it should end, but it's an important profit center for that party, that state party. I know they don't want to let it go. Oh, certainly it's absurd. But it did. It was a sign for you know, at the time, for Pawlenty to say, like, I have to get out of the race.
Right. Speaking of absurd, were you lured in at all or enticed by these specific eight candidates? And just to remind people, because it's an ADD society, so
sure.
People might not
it's
remember.
It's like an amazing cast of characters.
We have Mitt Romney, Rick Santorum, Michelle Bachmann, Rick Perry, Newt Gingrich, Herman Cain, Ron Paul, and then Pawlenty, who leaves very quickly. When you saw this motley crew, was that at all involved in, we got to shoot this?
Well, I didn't know much about Herman Cain when I first went to Iowa.
I don't think anybody did.
Yeah. So I didn't know what gold he was. I didn't kind of know the things I would later find so interesting about Newt. I didn't know. A lot of it, I don't think I knew the candidates well enough to be excited about them individually. I think I was intrigued by Michelle Bachmann going in, because as an Iowa native, because the Republicans had fallen so hard for Sarah Palin, because the Tea Party was such a thing, I think that in the beginning we really thought we might pay a lot of attention to, we actually were on a tour that the Iowa Tea Party did. That was one of the first things we did, was spend a lot of time with the people who ran the Iowa Tea Party. And they were doing these events where the candidates would come in because they wanted to garner support from the Iowa Tea Party. I think that we thought early on that was probably a bigger angle to what we would follow, which I think, you know, at that point no one had really done anything that sort of seriously looked at why, you know, instead of just assuming that they're racist or that they're, you know...
A bunch of jokers, really.
A bunch of jokers. You know, there's some people, I mean, I think there are some libertarian ideas behind some Tea Party folks that are not just valid, but, you know, probably important to have in the debate. They just didn't have very good spokespeople.
Right. Well, it's funny, because at your premiere, I was talking with Steve James, and I said to him, I was like, I'm younger than y'all, but it's like I really only first started paying attention to American politics around the time of Clinton, about the time of the war room that we just watched.
Yeah,
I was like, any time before that or since that, can you remember this kind of strange batch of candidates? And he said, no, I've never seen. And no, a lot of it, of course, unfolded as your film was following them along.
Yeah.
But that's, it's so strange to see what these people said, and even them going after each other. Like, at one point, the Republican, one of the higher-ups within the party was upset with Fox News within your film, because she thought that Fox News was getting them to go after one another than to go after the left.
Right.
So it was that was just really, really crazy.
Well, and the other thing just to add is that all of them lead the race at some point.
At one point or another.
And that's the other thing. It's like, not only is the cast of characters sort of unprecedented, but the fact that everyone is in first place at one time.
Yeah.
That has never happened before.
Yeah. So. And that's not even getting into the desire for people who didn't run.
That's right.
So, but that's a whole other film, I think. Yeah. Did you notice a difference? Well, you were filming them because you were around these people for like 3 months?
No, my first year was April, and we started shooting in May, and we were there till January. So
okay.
9 months.
So 9 months. Did you notice a difference in them when they weren't tub thumping? Like when they were off, I noticed that a lot in Santorum, who we'll get to him specifically.
Yeah.
But just as a general rule, did you kind of notice them flip a switch when they had a mic versus when they were just, did they ever like become themselves?
I think you see flashes of Michelle Bachman really is as our film progresses, because there's some moments sort of later in the film where we're the only people around, and I think we'd been around so long they weren't thinking about us very much.
Right.
I think you see the real Newt in our film.
He's a big lover of zoos.
He is. He does love zoos. No, I do. The thing we always try to do is we wanted to have the onstage moment and then followed by the offstage moment. We want to give context to the stuff that maybe you would see on TV.
Yeah.
And that was always the goal. So I think when you do see those offstage moments, you start seeing some pieces of people that you haven't seen before.
Yeah. So the first of three specific people who I wanted to talk about is Mitt Romney.
Yes.
Because this film really shows how much he was fighting two fronts. Like, he was fighting to take down Obama, and he was also fighting his own party.
Yeah.
Like, he seemed... You saw it a lot in the kind of people who went out to his rallies and his speeches and his events and whatnot, that he was not their choice. Like, he seemed to get into an argument almost every time.
Yeah.
Was it, like, strange kind of seeing that unfold and seeing somebody who, like you say, at one point was leading and ultimately went on to be the candidate, but just seemed to be so disliked within his own ranks?
You know, the funny thing about Romney is, I've talked to people who've spent time around him when he's not
on
or stumping, and they say that he's seems like a genuine guy. And then I talked to journalists who said, when they saw him in 2008, that he was just a terribly awkward candidate. I was shocked at how awkward he seemed in his interactions with people. The corporations or people line is an example of an awkward reaction. I mean, what he's trying to say, you can argue it, policy wise, but what he's trying to say is actually kind of true, in that, like, yes, money that corporations make does go to their, corporate heads and their boards and their shareholders and everything. But just not even thinking about how it sounds or how it comes out. His $10,000 bet with Perry. I think even the 47% stuff.
Well, I was going to say, he alludes to that. It became this gotcha moment within the campaign and might have ultimately been his undoing. I'd say that and Superstorm Sandy were probably what ultimately sealed it for Obama. But before that, even in front of a whole crowd, in front of news cameras, he alludes to 47% of this country pay no taxes, and it's moments like that where you're like, buddy, just help yourself a little bit. You're fighting two sides.
And that was actually, watching the campaign unfold, that was sort of when we realized the benefit of what we were doing, just in terms of the dialogue around this campaign, because we knew we had this footage of Romney talking about the 47%.
Yeah.
Now, there were other news cameras there.
No one ran it.
No one ran that. Yeah. No one pulled that out. None of the reporters who were there seemed to have it in their mind that this was actually something that Romney had talked about publicly before, not in a back room, not in a thing. So I think, you know, that was something that with the benefit of a long look at something, as opposed to like what's today's story, what are we driving for this 24-hour news cycle,
right?
You actually were able to like think about things over as more of an arc.
Yeah. And then we get Michelle Bachmann,
yes,
who is kind of, in a lot of ways, she is the second star of this show. She's like the undercard.
Yes, she is.
She's best supporting actress.
Best supporting actress, for sure. And
I say you nominate her. Put her name out there.
She should be summoned.
Please, yes. Yes, as we've heard. Yeah.
Just say that summoned is an inside joke based on the War Room screening that we just did when D.A. Pantybaker said that he was summoned to the Oscars,
yes,
which was meant that he had been nominated.
I do like that, by the way. Yeah. We kind of touched on this. Is she as odd as she seems, or is she just suffering from some really bad PR?
Well, my take on Bachmann early on was that she had the Joe Biden issue, which was she's someone who likes, and this is my own armchair psychiatry.
Okay.
But she's someone who likes talking. She's a reasonably intelligent, maybe very intelligent person. I think she's smarter.
She's pleasant.
She's smarter, I think, than people give her credit for. But she has a habit of going on these like tangents where she gets really in trouble. And one of the things that was interesting to us is, you know, we'd seen so many of her stump speeches, she would start saying something we'd never heard before. And at that moment, Nate and I would look over at her staff, and you would just see them start to cringe or put their hands over their face and the worried eyes, you know, like, what's coming? And you know, there's a few of those moments in the film where she says things that you just go, like, I can't believe, you know, that she just said that. But she was very, the way that she interacted with people, and I, you know, we tried to show a comparison between her and Sarah Palin, because Sarah Palin was also in Iowa, and I think that, you know, the way that they interacted with people, one was a celebrity interacting with fans,
yeah,
and one was someone who actually is a politician who knows how to, like, have a one-on-one exchange.
And who was deliberately trying not to follow in the other's footsteps.
Exactly. And the thing is Michelle Bachmann started off with a really good campaign team. And early on was really strong. She was kind of at the top of her game. And I went in, the first time I saw her give a speech, I was really surprised. I was like, that is a barn burner.
Yeah.
And it was not what you would sort of expect. It was definitely a Tea Party speech, but it was sort of a pox on both their houses. The Democrats are at fault, the Republicans are at fault. And it was a take that I didn't expect from her. And I thought, oh, she's got a good chance. But tons of things ended up going wrong, and I think you see a lot of that in the film, but it just, at a certain point, then it just felt like everything was falling apart.
Yeah. Now, if she's best supporting actress.
Yes.
Best supporting actor must be her husband.
Oh, yes.
Who is, I wanted more of him in this film. There's a lot of him in this film,
yes,
so well done for that.
Thank you.
I'm sure you couldn't resist. There's the moment that kind of sums it up for me is, and I'm sure he means well, but his wife is giving a speech in front of a room of people, and literally right behind her, he's having a thumb war with, yes, one of the audience members. This is just his way, or this is who he is? Like, was he ever groomed or anything, or what, like, is he just too awesome for words?
Yeah, you know, I think the thing with Marcus is that he, it was very funny, when we first went to Iowa, he wouldn't speak to the press.
Really?
He would have interactions with everyday Iowans. Again, some of these are in the film. There's a scene where he talks to someone who's bought a plant that he's very excited about. But anyone who went up to him from the press and said, can we do an interview? I'd like to talk to you. He would say, no, I'm not here for that. I'm just here to support Michelle.
Right.
And then he was not around a lot. Then toward the end of the campaign, he became much more vocal. And again, there had been some campaign changes in terms of who was part of their management. to me, I think that it showed to me, like, that, again, the sort of they were losing a little control of the message.
Right.
Because they were really disciplined at the beginning, and then towards the end, it sort of felt like there wasn't someone to rein in ways in which the campaign could be seen as being a little out of control.
Right.
And at that point, you know, I think Marcus was part of the campaign.
And that's probably around the time he's having thumb wars.
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't think there's any good argument to be made for a political spouse to be having arm wrestling, thumb wars, bets, tiddlywinks, anything going on with people over who they're going to vote for.
It's probably just a
bad idea.
Yeah.
I should have asked that about Penny and Chris tonight. But, yeah.
So that takes us to the star of the show, unlikely star of the show,
yes.
Rick Santorum.
Yes.
Who evolves and becomes, like, he's, I think, of everybody in this film, he is the only person who evolves, certainly for the better, and seems oddly down to earth. Like, it is very much summed up in that little infographic that he's proudly showing in the late going of, like, what everybody's using for their campaign, and for him the infographic is two dudes in a pickup truck.
Right.
Your producer said, as you guys were going through this film, you had conversations saying, does anybody else really like Rick Santorum? That had to be a weird feeling.
Sure, yeah. I mean, as we've said, I'm a Democrat. I'm pro-gay marriage. I'm pro-choice. I had not a lot of context for Rick Santorum beyond some of the, more scurrilous things that have been said about him from the left.
Sure.
That's why you make documentaries, I think. You know, it's like you go into a situation where you have either limited or, you know, an opinion about somebody, and you're allowed. I mean, I had several gay friends come up to me today and tell me that Rick Santorum made them cry.
Wow.
So, you know, I think and we're not trying to change hearts and minds, but I think we're just trying to say, like, you know, here's a guy who, you know, has strong beliefs, and they're based in his deeply held religious faith, and I have also deeply held religious beliefs that are different than his.
Yeah.
I think we can watch it and see, I understand where he's coming from. I understand what he believes, particularly on issues of life. I think it's good. It's good for all of us in the documentary world, where we're not often challenged. Where much of what is done is to, like, let us know how right we are.
Right.
To have someone come around and make us think harder. And, you know, the fact that it's Rick Santorum, I mean, I could never have, in a million years, would never have guessed that was going to be the case.
Well, yeah, like, I got to be honest, the weeks leading into this festival, I was wondering why you were CCing Rick Santorum on all of your tweets. I was like, is he stoned? What in the world is going on that he's
sure.
copying him? The one thing I like about it, actually, is that I think just worldwide, where politics and religion and those kind of divisive issues are concerned, we get so bogged down with where a person stands,
yeah.
and we forget to look at them as a person.
Sure.
And that's the thing. Like, when you guys were saying, who else likes Rick Santorum? You know, and I'm thinking, I kind of like him now. Like, I'm still completely opposed to him politically.
Sure.
Not that it matters, because I have no vote. But I'm like, I could sit down for a beer with this person.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I think, you know, especially, you know, for us, you know, we're from, like, if I go home and I hang out with my friends from high school and we started talking about politics, I probably would be, like, shocked, you know, yeah. where half of those people are at. And I love them deeply.
I get that with my family, too. So.
I get that from my family as well. So the notion that, like, I wouldn't be able to go and, like, find those similar characteristics in a politician who holds those beliefs, I think that's it was refreshing to us that we could find the humanity and see the humanity. Actually, I've shown the film, you know, as I was working on it, and a filmmaker friend of mine, someone who's liberal and very pro-choice, said, you know, I watched and in seeing his humanity, I was like, well, maybe I can have a conversation about something with someone who I don't think I can have a conversation with.
Yeah.
And again, you know, I think that's a
Yeah, it's important. No, it's important. Like you're underplaying it, but it is very important. You know, both of our countries are very divided, and you know, especially when something happens or somebody's in charge and you want to take them down or you want to get your point pushed through, yeah. It just becomes about the message, and you forget about you're yelling at somebody. You forget who you're actually yelling at.
Yeah.
A lot of the time.
Sure.
Did you end up scratching your head at his method? He to put a point on this, he made a point of campaigning in 100 counties in Iowa.
Yeah, 99.
I'm sorry, 99 counties in Iowa. I didn't even know there were 99 counties.
There are 99 counties, yeah.
And sometimes he's talking to a room of 10 people.
Yeah.
You're following this along. Did you ever think, dude, what are you doing?
Sure. Yeah, no, I mean, we would go to very remote places to shoot with him.
One traffic light?
Yeah. To his credit, he was usually in the larger town in a county, maybe okay. The county seat. But no, there were plenty of times where, you know, and he did very long things. And, you know, when you're shooting an entire, you know, town hall meeting, basically, that he's having with these 10 people that would go on for over an hour, you know, we weren't using tripods, so we're getting sore, you know, we're really far away from home. And like, there were times I think we left, you know, town hall
see you, Rick.
And we were just like, oh my God, if I have to see him again, like, in like the next couple of days, I'll drive the car off the road. But, you know, it was just a thing of he. I don't want to give impressions, but I do think that like he saw something, he certainly believed that he was making connections, and it was true that when the field cleared, and he made a couple of things that are in the film. He made a couple of really key speeches. One is that they're both at these kind of religious, social, conservative events. And he makes these two speeches. He gets some backing from some important social conservatives in the state of Iowa. And when Gingrich falls at the last minute, the door is opened, and he walks through.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. Before we kind of leave Santorum, I do need to thank you, because the one film I watched in amongst all these docs, just to kind of cleanse the palate, was I rewatched Ocean's 11. And short of Rick Santorum, I think Brad Pitt has to do the most eating in a film. I did love that almost every event, he's picking at the food. It's wonderful to see, just because it's one of those things, in films, you don't see people eat.
Yeah, no, I love seeing, like, I had forgotten Clinton eats.
Yeah.
He's eating the cereal. And I was like, oh my God, Rick Santorum is our Bill Clinton.
That's it. What did you, compared to what you saw in caucus, how would you kind of compare that to what you saw in convention, in terms of, you know, just the people gathered and the candidates, everything? Like, did you notice they were very much the same sort of people with the same sort of wants and desires, or was there a radical difference? Not even getting into just issues, but in terms of the people that were there and the people who were behind the microphone.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, the people in convention, you know, we were, like, following people in Denver who were planning a political convention, and they are, almost everyone in the film were long-time Coloradans, you know, generations. And they're just regular people, you know. And
folks.
Yeah, they're regular folk.
Yeah.
And it was... I loved being around those people because they had a real sense of civic duty, whether they were journalists or they were working for the city or they were working for... or they're the protesters, you know. I there was something very special about that, and there was a lot of similarity in in the ordinary Iowans that we met, which was that they took it very seriously, that they were doing they were working not just for themselves or for their party, but for the country. I mean, I think they felt like someone has said that Iowa goes first. We take it seriously. We're going to represent the United States, and we're going to try to, like, narrow this down to, like, two or three serious candidates. And it was actually kind of weirdly inspiring at times to sort of be around them, you know, because you saw how seriously they took it over such a length of time.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas most people are just like, oh, I'll decide, like, within a couple of days of the election. Like,
yeah, you hear undecided very, yeah. very late into the game, and you wonder, how can you possibly still be undecided?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The one thing I did notice that made me a little sad is, and it's probably indicative of just what your country is still going through, is there was a lot of fear and anger in these people. And I think that, you know, you can say what you want about, like, social conservatism or social liberalism or just, you know, economics. But in terms of what was happening, I felt that a lot of the times when they talked to these candidates, they were afraid and they were angry. And you could see it on their faces. Like, were you catching more of that or less of that? Or was it just little isolated bursts?
Well, the immigration issue, I think, you know, as the U.S. talks about immigration and as some Republicans understand, like, the importance of dealing with the immigration issue, they have really, you know, really pushed this to be a major issue, particularly in rural communities.
Yeah.
And so, you know, a lot of these towns in Iowa that had big manufacturing jobs don't have them anymore. And they have been told on talk radio and in other ways that the fault is not that of the corporations that left town.
Yeah.
The fault is not of government policies necessarily that, you know, didn't, maybe they are told that. But one of the things that they're hearing is that the jobs are going because people are coming primarily from Mexico.
Yeah.
And it's that's why things are bad. And they also will look in their small town and see that probably in the last 10 years there are 2 new Mexican restaurants.
Yeah.
The people who run them are not white.
Right.
And I think that they see, I think there is a fear that this is coming into every small town and every place and that they don't have a control over it. And I think that, you know,
it's valid.
Well, I think it's a thing where you can have a discussion of this issue, but the demagoguery around it, they let get out of control for so long that they're now reaping the fact that they've convinced people of what people think is like a plague problem, basically.
Yeah.
And we see this on the issue of guns. We see this on the issue of gay marriage. I mean, like, there's a core group of people who, even though a lot, there are, if you look at national Republicans or Republican strategists or consultants who understand that these issues are becoming toxic for the party, there is a base level within the party who has been convinced that they have to be afraid of these things.
Yeah.
It is a huge problem for them.
Yeah. So to kind of bring it back to where we started, what did you as a Democrat learn about Republicans after spending 9 months or so basically surrounded with them?
Well, you know, I mean, to me, it's just like, it's exciting to be in places, and it wasn't just 9 months, because we were in Branson, you know, before that, and Branson's a pretty Republican town. And, yeah, I just think you find that people are people, and, you know, people have different opinions, and sometimes the opinions are, you know, different and reasonable, and sometimes they're different and completely unreasonable. And we were in Iowa early on, and I was trying to get a shot of Michelle Bachmann, and I was standing on a cement column right next to a car, and I was actually kind of thinking, like, if I can I step on the car to, like, balance myself, because I'm on, like, a very narrow thing.
Yeah.
And older gentleman came up to me and he said, "Young man, that's my car there." And I'm like, okay, he's going to say, like, "Don't step on my car." And he was like, "You are welcome to climb up on the hood or the roof, wherever you can get a better shot." And I was like, well, you know.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, I'm sure that I don't agree politically with that gentleman at all, but, you know, he's, I mean, he should get a credit in the film.
That's very judicious of you.
Yeah.
One thing I did forget to mention, actually, that I did want to ask you about is that you make a deliberate choice not to ridicule. Now, there's moments in this film where people ridicule themselves.
We let them do their thing.
But, you know, I mean, I get a lot I get a lot of my information about your country through Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert.
Sure.
And Republicans just seem like an easy target. Democrats, of course, are an easy target, too.
Yes.
Media and government are very, very easy pickings. But what was the process in your brain of, we don't want to mock? Because it seems like it's there. Like, even just in the first shot of the film, I'm sure you could probably hear a snicker ripple through the crowd on that first shot.
Sure.
But it's just, it is what it is, and we go on.
Yeah.
Was there a deliberate thing saying, okay, we're just going to cover this. We're not going to make fun. We're not going to be those guys.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, we deliberately were like, we're not making fun, and we're going to do this thing, and we're just going to... We'll do what Bob Drew and Penny and Chris and everyone did before us, and we'll observe and we'll show, and then people can approach it as they will. There are so many moments in the film that are surreal and funny and weird, and people fall down, and people, you know, like, things happen.
Yeah.
And that became an obvious storyline in the film. It's just like, part of this is going to be that these people are human and things are going to fall apart around them.
Yeah.
And that's humorous, and I don't think you have to be I'm sure that Republicans will see it and will laugh as well.
It's refreshing.
Yeah.
So, you have been a very vocal advocate for documentary and nonfiction film.
Yeah.
Along with the fact that I first got introduced to you when you brought Kurt Cobain about a son, which, by the way, is still one of my favorite documentaries.
Thank you.
Ever. I also became familiar with you from your blog that you wrote, All These Wonderful Things. Why nonfiction? Like, were you always drawn to that, or were you the guy who was listening to prog rock while your other friends were listening to punk? Like, what was it about nonfiction that called to you?
I was always interested in journalism. I studied journalism in college, and I actually worked at a TV station as a reporter and a weekend anchor.
Okay.
And I think at a certain point I realized that one of the problems was sort of local news, and this isn't about, you know, people who are allowed to do longer pieces, but it's the notion, like, everything had to be told in 90 seconds.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to do that. You know, it's like, I want to tell long stories. I make longer films. Both of the films I have here at Hot Talks are one is 100. One is an hour 44 minutes. The other is an hour 49
thanks
minutes.
Thanks for that, by the way.
Yeah. And, you know, and in both cases, like, you know, I know that there are people who will be like, a documentary shouldn't be longer than 90 minutes. And which is, I've kind of been on a little bit of a crusade about it, which we've been fighting to say that documentaries can be anything, but you'll still run into people who'll be like, but it's got to have a time limit, my God.
You hear that about films in general now,
sure, yeah,
right?
Yeah. No, I mean, I films should be the length that they should be.
Yeah.
I started watching documentaries and sort of seriously in high school. And some of the first ones I saw were... Maisel's Brothers films, Koyaanis Katsi. And, you know, they weren't... I'm sure I'd seen more journalistic films, but what was exciting to me about them were that these felt like... I saw a lot of music docs, too. Let's stop
making sense. Course.
And Don't Look Back. You know, you start thinking, like, well, no, it's not... It's about that you're actually... you're making real movies... I remember having this thought early on, is that they were real movies. They weren't like a subset. They just happened to have real people in them.
Okay.
And when the technology started changing and we could do things in different ways, I thought, like, in the same way that Penny, you know, invented technology to allow people to have sync sound.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, now we have these, you know, we have this ability to do so many things. I mean, I, you know, watching that film today, talking about caucus, I looked at it and I was like, that movie is almost 95% made by two guys.
Right.
With handheld equipment and a laptop.
And it looks handsome.
It looks handsome.
And it sounds handsome.
Yes.
It's a film. It's not just... It's not news coverage cut together.
Right. And that's... The fact that you can do that, and that I can bring my stylistic desires and energies to that, and I don't have to rely on... I mean, I want to get paid, don't get me wrong. but I don't have to rely on... We could make this film because we had a little bit of money ourselves, and we could put flights and beer and hotels and rental cars on our credit card.
Right. I did think of the two questions I wanted to ask you, because you and I were talking about having this conversation, Hot Docs, 3 years ago.
Awesome.
And I've been like sitting on it that long.
I like delayed gratification.
Yeah. Well done. So the first question is The Measure of a Doc.
Yeah.
Because I've watched more and more and more as the years go on. And I'm at a point, and I've heard this question from other people. Is it enough anymore that we've kind of reached a threshold where documentary filmmaking has really taken off? Part of it's technology, part of it's just a different approach. Is it still just the matter of telling the story of one space and time or an issue? Or does it have to be underneath a certain degree of filmmaking? So, as a for instance, as much as I enjoyed, or enjoyed is the wrong word, but as much as I was engaged by the story of the Invisible War, and it's a very important story, and it's very important that it gets out there.
Sure.
I found that film, filmmaking-wise, and technically, very unpleasant, very ugly, versus something that's fluffy, or you know, like, I'm going to use, just as an example, March of the Penguins,
yeah.
Which, again, they're apples and oranges, but it's visually and structurally engaging more. Is it enough, still, just to shed light on an issue, or is there now a push to do it with a little bit of panache?
Well, I think when I started being a vocal, you know, bastard about, you know, my feelings about art.
I'm going to use that, by the way.
Yeah. About that we're artists and that we're making art. You know, it was important, I think, and I spoke with big words and, you know, I was a man full of piss and vinegar. Because I thought it was important that we had a smack to the side of the head. I thought it was important that we had to face the fact that so much of the infrastructure and the conversation around documentary was based on either journalism or saving the world.
Right.
And that was making it harder for films that didn't want to be that, which, again, we didn't pioneer it. Corian Scotzi, everything Maelstrom did, everything Penny Baker did.
Baraka.
Yeah. All these generations of amazing filmmakers. We had to make sure that, like, we weren't losing track of the fact that there was a heritage to this, and that even if, you know, this is what was being programmed by certain festivals, or this is what was being awarded at the Oscars, or this is what critics looked at it, we had to start, you know, raising our hands and fighting. I think we have had some success in having people who write about film, people who watch films, people who think about film, you know, understand that it is a genre that, yes, films like The Invisible War and Food Inc. and, you know, I mean, I think Food Inc.'s a terrifically made film.
Yeah, well, me too.
You know, but that these films should exist, and they should be part of our canon. They're part of the nonfiction universe. But no more so or less so than Chappatoulas, or Only the Young, or October Country,
Leviathan.
Or Leviathan, or Sweetgrass, or, that to me is the dialogue I hope we're having. And the exciting thing to me now is not so much to be like, I credit everyone who's having this discussion right now. Robert Greene is, like, really pushing this, and a lot of other critics are writing and talking about it. I think if we can come to a point where the value is equal, and that there can be in this world these artistic and experimental films and these like educational and journalistic films, that's where it would be.
You think there's place at the table for all?
Yeah, no, there should be. And I think we're still fighting for a little bit of equality, for the artistic and the experimental. But you know, I think we're getting closer, and I think that you know the fact that you know, there are festivals like True False, and I think what we're trying to do at Cinema Eye, and you know, what some very good writers like Eric Hines and Robert and a few others are trying to talk about. And yeah, I think we're having a conversation. That's what we should be doing, is having a conversation.
And, absolutely.
And we're lucky to have, you know, folks like Chris and Penny, who like have been part of that forever and have fought against people going like, you know, why didn't the War Room win the Oscar when they were nominated? Someone asked Chris, what won? And she said it was an HBO film that never was in theaters.
Never heard of again.
Yeah. So, you know, this isn't a new fight.
Right.
I think that sometimes we get like a little lost in the idea that like, you know, this is the first time anyone's ever been like taking to the barricades.
Yeah.
No, we're on a long journey.
The second question that I've had to wait 3 years to answer.
Yes.
Is there's a little bit of a, I don't want to say a stigma, but there's kind of an arm twisting that goes with trying to get general audiences to watch documentary film. Like, yeah. I get some of my coworkers going, what, you're watching docs for a week and you're running around town doing it? And even my own readership takes a little bit of a dip when I'm talking about documentaries that people haven't seen yet. But there's a weird little paradox that you can't get somebody to watch a well-crafted film about things that are happening in our world, and yet they will happily, maybe even mindlessly, watch 22 minutes after 22 minutes over families that breed ducks, and people selling stuff at pawn shops, and celebrities walking around. Is there just no bridging one to the other? Is it just going to be dumb luck? Is there any way you can... We're a reality-obsessed, voyeuristic society now.
Yeah.
Which makes me wonder how it is that we can't get some more numbers towards nonfiction and documentary filmmaking. Are they just two completely separate entities? Or is there maybe a pull that can happen?
No, I mean, I think that people... one thing that reality television has done in its myriad forms, and there's competition reality, there's observational reality, there's, you know, I think it does have people look at the longer form documentary in different ways. I mean, we don't talk about it very much, but I don't think it's coincidental that the rise of reality television that began in 1999 and 2000 parallels what many people consider to be, you know, one of the most exciting times ever in documentary feature filming. So it also has led to the blurring of the lines. You know, we have an award at CinemaEye called the Heterodox Award, which is for films that are narrative but use documentary and nonfiction practices in their work. I mean, you look at, in the U.S., we have sitcoms like, you know, The Office and Modern Family and a number of others that use a documentary format to tell their stories.
Yep.
And I think that everything's becoming more blurred. And I think that we can't think that, like, just because we don't have the ratings or the numbers of...
Or the gate, the box office.
Right. Of a big reality show or a big fiction film. We have all these outlets now. And the fact that, like, you know, a film... You know, someone asked me, like, well, you know, where do people see Caucus? Do they see it in a theater? Do they see it on television? Do they see it online? And, you know, it's like, I want people to have the experience that you guys got to have here. I want people to be in a theater and laugh and be in a crowd and feel that thing. But then I think, well, how do we watch The Daily Show?
Yeah.
We go online because someone tweeted something and it's interesting, and then we can go and watch it.
Yeah.
So I think we have to be a little less precious about the idea of how people see our things, when they see it, and in what format.
And you think that might lead to the widening of the audience, that some of the people who are like this?
Yeah, I know. I do. I think that when we get, well, and not, obviously not every film. My friend Jessica Oreck made this beautiful film about reindeer farmers in Finland.
Right.
And it's playing at the festival. I mean, like, that's not something. I mean, that's an immersive experience. You can watch it on your computer, you could watch it on your television, but you wouldn't want to watch it on your phone.
No.
So I think that, you know, there's, you know, we're figuring it out. It's a good journey. I think we're on a journey, and I think it's a good journey.
It mirrors, in a nice little way, it mirrors the technology that has been able to facilitate you making these films.
Yeah.
That the technology is now there that people can consume these films. Because, like, let's face facts. If you've got a 3-screen film as the theater in Iowa, they're going to be playing the Avengers, and they're going to be playing Superman and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, Caucus is going to have a hard time getting that screen.
Yeah.
But everybody's got access to a computer. Everybody can get iTunes and Netflix and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And get access to these things.
Well, I know, I'll say what, you know, when I made my first film about They Might Be Giants, Gigantic, it came out in 2003, and I was in Chicago, and the paper, the Tribune or the Sun-Times, I don't remember which it was, but, you know, they had the reviews, and we were on one page, and the Hulk was on another page.
That had to be trippy.
And I realize that there were people in the world who were going to be saying, do we see Gigantic or do we see the Hulk? And that's, when you're in theaters, that's what's happening.
Sure.
You know, people who want to go to a movie, like, are going to make a choice between Atsinki and Iron Man 3. And you got to be ready for that.
Of course. That's an answer worth waiting 3 years for, so good job.
Awesome, thank you.
What's next for Caucus?
I know where it's going next, but I can't say because this has not been announced.
Look at you! It's looking for a scoop or something. Well, you've been, like, totally generous with your time, so
awesome.
I wish you nothing but good things for this film. I think it's something that people, you know, we're not speaking as political animals, we're speaking as people who make films and watch films, and I think just as a piece of filmmaking, it is something that deserves to be seen. So I hope it's good things in store for Caucus, and I thank you for sitting down with us.
No, I appreciate it, and try to come up with some questions now, and we'll get to them sometime in 2017.
Exactly.
Pretty sure that was worth waiting 3 years for. So my thanks again go out to AJ Schneck for being so very generous with his time and for presenting such wonderful films such as Caucus and We Always Talk to Strangers, which I'm actually quite anxious to see. If you want more information about Caucus, or certainly to see when it might be coming near you, you can find its website by going to caucusfilm.com. You can also follow it on Twitter, where it is @caucusdoc. Hot Docs continues until this Sunday, May the 5th. More information on screening times and tickets can be found by going to the festival's website, hotdocs.ca. As for me, you can find more episodes of the Matinee Cast, both full and my Hot Docs dispatches, by going to thematinee.ca/podcasting. You can also find them by going through Listen, Apple's podcasting app, Stitcher Radio, Blueberry, and the iTunes Store. They all give you ways to subscribe and get alerts when new episodes drop. Feedback on any of this or my Hot Docs coverage can be sent to ryan@thematinee.ca, Twitter, where I'm matinee_ca, or Facebook, facebook.com/docmatinee. My thanks again to AJ Schneck. Until next time, I'm Ryan. We'll see you at the matinee and at Hot Docs.